The Home Show with Sinead Ryan on News Talk.
Hello and you're very welcome along to the latest episode of the Home Show podcast with me, Sinead Ryan. It is, of course, Easter weekend. So from whipping the herring to egg hunts, we're going to look at some of the stranger Easter traditions and where they came from. We're joined by Home of the Year's Hugh Wallace, the design legend, who joins us to tell us how he judges Ireland's houses and brings us a personal story. And Niamh Maher will be here with some last minute tips to get your home ready for Easter. If you'd like to get involved in our podcast, you can email us during the week at thehomeshow@newstalk.com. You'll find me over in Instagram at SineadRyan100, and you're very welcome along.
When I look over here, I just think, twinkle, twinkle, little star. I'm looking at the universe because of the fleck in the splashback. Isn't that great?
Now that, of course, was the dulcet tones of my first guest. And as the 10th series of Home of the Year approaches the final, you might be worried that you'll be deprived of some Hugh Wallace screen time over the next couple of months. But fear not, our intrepid architect is also appearing in series 2 of the Great House Revival and indeed is in our very studio now. Hugh Wallace, you're very welcome.
A very good morning to you.
It's lovely to see you. Now, I have to say, we're all very relieved you're still on air. Can you go anywhere these days? You walked up here this morning now. I'm sure you were accosted half a dozen times.
Ah, isn't it wonderful? People are so nice.
Are they?
Yeah, they're so nice. And I tell you, the two shows are fabulous because I love Home of the Year, a half-hour family romp in which there's no bad language, lots of inspiration, and then that little niggle between Amanda and myself, which I just adore.
Yeah, and the little niggles have kind of got slightly bigger niggles over the series, haven't they? I mean, she's not afraid to express her opinion.
I know, even if she's wrong. and that's what I love. And Amanda is, sorry, Sarah is there with the whistle. Mm. Very important to have a ref. But you see, Amanda and I forget that Sarah has the deciding vote.
Oh, right. Okay.
So.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
So you can go town. And you do have very different views on things.
Yeah.
And Amanda has made no kind of not hiding behind the fact that she is quite minimalist. She loves the clean lines, you know, less is more. And on some of the houses that you've been looking at, there was one, I think it was last week's episode, not the one that's just gone out. There was an Art Deco home, which I adored. I thought it was absolutely incredible because that's my favourite period.
Right.
But it was up against this maximalist kind of townhouse in a very ordinary estate.
Yeah, loved it.
It was a bit bonkers. She wasn't a huge fan of it now.
No, she wasn't. But, you know, that's why the show is fabulous, because homes are about your personal taste and you can do whatever you want. And that's what I love. As long as you do it consistently. And that lady most certainly did it consistently.
And is that the trick? So it's not like mishmashing a whole load of styles together.
Correct. So it's about personality. And what I loved about that particular house was it was absolutely unique. You would have never seen that anywhere else. There was no Pinterest imagery. There was nothing. It was all about her creativity and her love and passion.
Some people would call it now clutter.
I know, but it isn't. In that house, it wasn't.
Yeah.
Because she made everything. Yeah. You know, she made the cushions. She did the artwork, lovely colours. It was wild.
And you wouldn't have told it, kind of known it from the outside of the,
Not
the property.
Not at all. It looked like just an ordinary estate home. And that's what I love when we're opening the door.
And when you do open the door of those houses, you know, I mean, look, it's entertainment, it's television. Have you genuinely no idea what's behind it?
No. That's what's great about the show. Like, so I've looked at 225 homes over the 10 years of Home of the Year. And I just love standing outside and wondering why we're here. Do you know what I mean? You're up at, say, up going up to that house. So you're going, why are we at this house? And then you open the door and you go, now I understand. I love it or I hate it.
So there's a team who whittle down the applicants and then they just, like, these are the guys you're going to see and you're going to choose.
We rock up at the door. The great thing about Home of the Year and the Great House Revival is I get to see parts of the country I've never been in my whole life.
Okay.
And I just love it. And the country is amazing. And for me, as a gastro yummy, I just adore it because I go to these amazing delicatessens restaurants and food emporiums right. around Ireland. And there are so many.
Yeah, indeed. We have an ongoing, and it seems endless, fascination in this country, not only with property, but with property porn.
Yeah.
And the shows, including your own, show no sign of abating.
No, no.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think people are looking for homes first and foremost. So in the Great House Revival, it's about couples going out and buying old buildings and doing them up.
Mm.
And like the one last Sunday was fabulous. If you take it after the grant, so they got a grant of 50,000, the total cost to buy and renovate that home was around 230,000.
Mm.
That's what it's cost them. And they have a stunning home. And please understand, that can be repeated time and time again around our countryside and in our towns and villages.
Yeah, we'll talk about the grants in a minute because I know it's a big part of this Croí Cónaithe, you know,
yeah,
the town's
fantastic.
Plan. But like a project like that, you know, which is effectively for some people and in that particular one of those episodes, like a pile of bricks, you know, with a roof on it. How, like, there's a romanticism, I think, when you're looking at that and that sense of, oh, you know, they got from here to here and wasn't it amazing and doesn't it look fantastic? Do you think it might lull people into a sense, a false sense of security that this is straightforward or easy?
No, I don't think the programme presents things as being straightforward. I think they are complex. And my personal belief is that if you're willing to do your homework and that you're not in an absolute rush, that you can do a lot of work yourself, particularly in the stripping out.
Mm.
And that's all about money and time in terms of employing someone. But if you're willing to do that, you can make the difference. And like, there's amazing stuff online. People go, oh, I have a secondhand kitchen.
Mm.
There's amazing secondhand kitchens for sale, which somebody put in 20 years ago, 10 years ago. And all that needs to happen is the door's replaced, the carcass is perfect, and a new countertop.
Yeah, and it's about that, maybe having that vision that maybe lots of us don't have. You know, we just say, no, we'll buy it new. We'll let somebody else have the vision board.
No.
But being able to do that yourself. How do you know, Hugh, like from an architect's point of view, when something is beyond salvageable? Because I you know, people, okay, the building mightn't cost them that much, but the renovation will.
Yes.
And they have to know, presumably, before they go ahead, is this a raised project and start again? Or can we work with what we have?
You have to bring in your specialists. That's the time to bring in your architect, your engineer, to give you an overview on the project. And to they should also give you sort of parameters of the amount of work that has to be done and the difficulty of the project.
Mm.
But in Sully's case and Mary Clare.
Oh, they were fabulous, weren't they?
But they didn't get an engineer to look at the building.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah, and they found...
Didn't stop them.
No, and there were floors the wrong height, steps going in and out of all the rooms, ceilings... You banged your head off the ceiling at one stage.
Staircases had to come down, the whole thing.
Why would a house be built like that in the first place? I mean, it was
it's time. It has to do... because houses were built over time.
Yeah, yeah.
And sort of people added on.
Bits
That's
added.
What happened.
Okay, okay.
So it's just the staircase would not have been where it was...
Yeah.
It would have been in the hall. And over time, things change. That's what happens.
Okay.
And actually, I love that. I love the quirkiness of some of the houses. So one of the houses we're following is the old post office in Butlerstown down in County Cork.
Yeah.
And that staircase is amazing because it's all over the place. And I just love it.
And talk to me then a little bit about what a game changer the grants have been. Because under this... vacant, and we've discussed it on the show with the minister, the vacant and derelict homes grant.
Correct.
And as far as I can recollect, the vacant, if a house is vacant, you can get up to 30,000 and if 50, and if it's derelict,
you get an extra 20.
An extra 20. Okay.
Well, if it's derelict and there's structural work,
okay,
then you get the extra 20.
Okay.
And that's a huge amount of money.
Is it?
Yeah.
even in the grand, yeah, but even in the grand scheme of some of these very run down.
Yeah, but look at, again, I'd go back to Mary Claire and Sully.
Mm.
So they brought their project down from sort of two, say, 280 down to 220. It's a huge amount of money.
Yeah. Now, it can be hard to get a mortgage on those properties because a lot of the banks kind of have the view that if it's a project for you, it's, you know, it's a declined asset for us. And I think there's a rule under it.
That's a very big word.
Yeah.
A declined asset. Oh, well, my, I'm telling you.
I'm thinking about a bank surveyor going out and thinking, are you nuts? Are you, what are you doing here? Now, obviously, if they run into you, Wallace, on site, they'll be, sure, we'll be grand, he's be here. Grand. But, you know, it's not something to be taken on lightly.
No,
so
no.
From that perspective, can the finances get out of hand quite quickly? And how can you ensure that they stay on schedule?
By being involved, by really, you know, delving in, doing your Excel sheets, you know, that's what you have to do.
I mean, micromanaging.
You must micromanage. Mm. And it's like, if you're going to run out of money, that's what happens. So don't put the ensuite bathroom in. Put in all your services. And when you have 15 grand, you can do the ensuite.
Okay.
You know, buy a secondhand kitchen for 2 grand. Put it in.
Yeah.
Live with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when you have money, put in your kitchen you want. Don't put down your floors. You know, paint your concrete floor. And when you have a bit of money, put down your timber floor.
Okay.
You know, you really can. The most important thing is to get the house sealed, the insulation done.
Yeah.
And that you can physically move in there.
The invisible spend.
Correct.
Mm.
Absolutely.
Okay.
But that's the spend you must do.
Okay.
After that, you know, you can buy, as I said, honestly, you'll buy a secondhand kitchen for 2 grand. You go to the panel centre and you buy a kitchen.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can live with that.
And I saw that couple, they had got something on Dundeal or, you know, some of these free sites or cheap sites.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, back to Home of the Year, because I know you're coming up to the final, the broadcast of the final now soon.
2 weeks.
It is, yeah.
I'm all excited to find out who wins. Are you? I'm all excited.
Are you? I'd say you're a little less excited than the rest of us.
Oh, no, I'm all excited.
But come here
to
me.
Which house will win?
How do you, and I'm always interested to know, how you and Sarah and Amanda, because you've each got, obviously, your very own individual taste. How do you separate?
And house we want to win.
And house you want to win.
Absolutely.
How can you, or do you even bother trying, to be objective when you look at a project or a house and separate maybe your own kind of what you love versus what's good or poor?
Well, I think in funny enough, in Home of the Year, it's the intangible that makes the house special.
I don't know. Describe
when
that.
When I go into a home, how do I feel? Does the home make me happy? Do I feel I have to put a coaster down before the coffee arrives, like this studio? Do you know, there'd be a shame now if you put the coffee down without a coaster.
Yes, so it's so beautiful.
I'm just telling you, like it's pièce de résistance.
I think he's been sarcastic, folks. Carry on.
So I'm just saying it's those things.
Yeah.
You can actually tell if it's a fun family home and you get a nice atmosphere.
So it's an emotional response then rather than a clinical one.
Yeah, it has to be. You can't, you know, they're all amazing homes, particularly the final seven. So please, you know, they're all winners.
Yeah.
But it is an emotional reasoning. And then, if you like, we'd all have three houses that we want to get into the final three. And if you like, it's like playing chess. You know, you have to be willing to lose the rook to make sure your king
wins. So there's a strategy then about bumping them up and down the table.
Oh, God, Oh, I tell you.
It's a bit of poker going on
there
as
is,
well.
And big emotions.
Okay.
Big emotions. Like, we are all invested in these homes.
Yeah.
And so the final now is touch and go.
Competitive. All right. Well, one thing, just take a left turn for a moment, because one thing is for sure, I think, whoever the winner is and whatever the final looks like, you won't be celebrating with champagne. I saw you on television recently on Upfront with Katie Hannon talking about the nighttime economy and the new legislation that's coming in. And some viewers might have been surprised by the candidness around your disclosure of alcoholism.
My journey. Yeah, but my journey is well known. Mm. I've discussed it lots. And I think that if more people discussed it and were opened, then you'd have pulled up the corner in the carpet. Society has to pull the corner of the carpet up.
Mm.
And we aren't. We're not willing to go there as a nation. And so it's keep it in the family. And that's no good. Alcohol is purely a disease. If I have cancer, I go to the doctor. In Ireland, if you have alcohol or if you have alcoholic problems in the family, keep it in the family. And it's not dealt with. There are no services available, particularly for children under 15. There are absolutely nothing. So if you're lucky enough to get into counselling on the basis you plead with them, it'll take 6 months, maybe 1 year. At the age of 18, that service ends. Stops.
This
stops.
Is for children living families with an alcoholic.
Yeah, who have depression, anxiety, suicide tendencies, whatever you want. But at 18, that stops. It literally, on your birthday, they go, thank you, and close the file. And they don't give the file to anyone else. Mm. Nothing. So you have to start again. You know, for me, what should happen is the drinks industry should be asked to put in $500 million a year, that goes to an office for the harmful reduction of alcohol, which is in the bill, but that's been left to last, which is the most important bit.
They would say there's a lot of levies on drinks already, and the government is spending it on programs.
Drink shouldn't be cheap. Mm. It's too cheap. It shouldn't be cheap.
Would price have put you off in the past from drinking?
It does put people off. You can look at the statistics.
Mm.
So in increasing the hour by 1 hour, there will be a 16% increase in fatalities and accidents on the road.
Mm.
That is proven by what has happened in Northern Ireland and in Norway. So it's there we go. But as usual, within the bill, where is there anything about counselling? Where is there anything to provide solutions? Not really, in my opinion, to the alcoholic, who should be seen immediately, but more to the people around them.
What age were you when you were diagnosed?
Diagnosed? I was 50. I went to the doctor when I was 55, and he said, oh, you're an alcoholic. And I went, thank God. Now I know what's wrong.
Really?
So I'm not going to die. That was my reaction. I'm not going to die.
Because it was diagnosed as a disease for you?
Yeah.
Or because you didn't realise that you were an alcoholic?
Of course I knew, but nobody had ever said it to me.
Okay.
So when the doctor turns around and says, with simplicity and authority, you are an alcoholic, you go, okay. So then I could take steps, you know. But no, like, nobody turns around in a family and says, you're an alcoholic, you're affecting my life.
Is that a cultural thing an Irish thing? And tell me, like, up to that age, you were a fantastically successful architect. You were running a busy practice. You must have been a functioning alcoholic. And lots of people are, of course. How was that for you? What did that look like?
It was just, well, in the final years, I wasn't functioning. I'd seen pink elephants. I'd gone. I'm not trying to be glib about this. Alcohol is a scourge in the country. 20% of the population have been directly affected by alcohol, either in their childhood or today. So, you know the way we think, some children are affected. You know that the quantity of children affected now, today, because the statistics aren't quite there, is somewhere between 60,000 and 100,000 children tonight are affected by alcohol, and every night 1,500 beds in our over possessed hospital system with people in stretchers in our A&E, 1,500 beds tonight are full because of people resulting from alcohol.
So, okay, well then just to as a final comment then, and you were clearly really passionate about this, Hugh, as lived experience. Simon Harris, we have a new Taoiseach coming in. What would you encourage him to do in his 1 year that he has remaining?
To instigate the entire bill, alcohol bill, in its entirety, not cherry pick to the whim of the drinks industry, which is what has happened and is happening still.
All right. Well, Hugh Wallace, Home of the Year, the final is on the 9th of April. Thank you very much for joining us in studio today for that. Tomorrow, lots of us will be doing an Easter egg hunt or putting up ribbons or cooking some lamb. And if you're really old school, you might be whipping the herring, whatever that is, but I am about to find out, because we're going to look now at some of the traditions around Easter, which is such an ancient festival, and what, if anything, they have to do with Christianity. I am joined now on the line by Kelly Fitzgerald, Professor of Folklore at UCD, and Clodagh Tait, a historian from the Mary Immaculate College in Limerick. You're both very welcome to the show, ladies, and happy Easter to you both. Kelly, if I can start with you, we know Easter marks the end of Lent, the celebration of new life in the form of the risen Christ in religious terms. How did we get to chocolate eggs, do you think?
Well, exactly as you said there, Sinead, I mean, the end of Lent, and particularly in a time when people really practiced a very severe kind of life during those 40 days before Easter, you need a bit of luxury at the end of it. And we see that when we think of anything in, around Easter and the kind of lunch or anything around that, the importance of that kind of exception. So chocolate has done very well taking that place, and people love it. And in some ways, we see something, it feels very ancient to us, but of course, the history of chocolate in its own right could tell us that it's not that old, but it's really, really important to us, and it's absolutely a part of our tradition.
Now, I'm wondering some part of our tradition that may not be as old as chocolate, and I'm thinking of the Easter bunny. I mean, why a bunny, and where did it come from, do you know?
Well, again, the Easter bunny, it's one of those things, again, it's first kind of thought of, or we have an entry of it from the early modern period, not in England or Ireland or within this side, but we do have it. And it's always, it's a very strong thing on the continent, and this sense of it. And we could see that the connections of fertility, of renewal, of rebirth, like the lamb, the bunny is the rabbit or the hare, is a very good image that represents what we see here in the springtime. And we see when that kind of increase of in the 19th century, when everyone was trying to really understand everything, they kind of give these kind of connections from earlier times. And that may or may not be true, but it has stuck. They are cute. And again, they are definitely a part of the tradition. And I would be curious to see how strong is the Easter Bunny in Ireland now. The last time I did actual field work on it would be some years ago, and it wasn't as strong, but I see it definitely increasing here now.
Field work on the Easter Bunny. Well, that sounds like a job I missed out on my CV when I was leaving school. That sounds like a phenomenal job. Let me go now, Kelly, to Clodagh Tait. Clodagh, you're a historian and you've been looking at a lot of the older traditions, or maybe very localised traditions. And one of them, now, of course, we know like a lot of the Easter stuff is around children no more than Christmas and the other religious festivals. But the Clodagh feast, talk to me a little bit about how children were involved in that old tradition.
Yes, well, the Easter Bunny might be relatively recent, but children have been collecting eggs in Ireland for many generations. So in the north of Ireland, the Clodagh was when children would go from place to place, either the week before Easter or perhaps on Easter Saturday or Sunday or even Easter Monday, and they'd collect eggs from their neighbours and then have a big feast. They'd light a fire, they'd light their own fire, and they'd boil the eggs and have a party. And this is called the Clodagh in the north of Ireland, but you hear it called the Tobies in the southwest or the southeast So I don't know where that one came from.
Okay, so that's interesting. And that makes a lot of sense, because eggs presumably would have been, would they have been a special food, or would most small holdings have kept chickens and therefore they didn't eat them during Lent, or they would, certainly wouldn't have eaten the meat during Lent?
They weren't allowed to eat the meat, and they were allowed to eat eggs most of the time, not on Good Friday, but they would have been more sparing. Mm. And the thing about the eggs on Easter Day was that you could eat lots and lots of them. It was sort of a feast of eggs, and almost a competition about who could eat the most.
Okay, all right. And there were other traditions which I haven't heard of, and I referred to it at the top, one called whipping the herring. What is that?
Well, this was the revenge of the butchers and the butchers' apprentices and other people who made money out of farming and selling cattle and meat. And so at the end of Lent, when everybody was sick of eating the herrings and the dried fish that they would have had to eat during the fasting time of Lent, they're looking for a bit of a celebration, and the butcher's apprentices would lead processions in towns like Dundalk and Drogheda with a fish at the end of a stick, and they'd drown the herring in a river or something like that. At the end of the procession to take revenge on the herring that everyone was sick of.
God, sounds very violent altogether. Kelly, when it comes to food, I mean, obviously, clearly the herring isn't popular around Christmas, around Easter, but there are lots and lots of things that are. And I think most of us probably know the significance of the hot cross bun, because as far as I understand it, the cross signifies Jesus on the cross, and it's specifically to do with that Easter. But what about the simnel cake? What is that, and what is it about those foods?
Yeah. And again, if we think of the simnel cake, and I just going back again, if we think of the eggs and having a time of the year that you could eat as many eggs as you want, it's really important to have a day like that, but you couldn't live like that because the eggs were so important for the family in terms of selling the eggs at the market. So It's wonderful you have a time of year for that. And again, even thinking of the butchers being upset of the money they've lost during Lent. So as much as this seems as these vernacular traditions, it's fantastic just to look at how the economics of the household and the economics within a community are coming through. And perhaps even when we think of the simnel cake, it's very luxurious. I mean, here we have, you know, you have the kind of marzipan and this really kind of rich, luxurious cake that's being made. And this image, there's so much about the everything has this kind of symbolism in it, whether it's renewal or spring or what have you. And there you have the 12 apostles, these kind of balls of marzipan on the top of the cake, representing the apostles all except Judas, of course. He can't make it on there. and then decorating it, and the sense of decorating it with flowers and a bit of decoration. This isn't something you see in other times of the year. So all of that kind of really making Easter and Easter Sunday so important for people.
And were there other foods that were important to the Easter table? I mean, lamb would seem to be the obvious one, and the association now with the bunny maybe is coming clearer for me. And was it just the indulgent nature of the foods that was important?
Yeah. Again, yes, think of it, spring lamb, you know, to have, you know, this isn't mutton stew. You're having a wonderful leg of lamb. Mm. And it's that sense. And I love when we look at traditional cultures, it's how they've worked out. When can you give yourselves a bit of luxury and the need for that luxury? And particularly after this time that you have proven your beliefs, you've proven what you can do as Jesus Christ has suffered, our Lord has suffered. We have been suffering for 40 days, apart from Patrick's Day. We have been suffering. And now let us rejoice and come together and really look forward. I mean, in Irish tradition, of course, spring is much earlier than Easter would be coming, but you really get a sense of what spring feels like now. And this sense before the hard work of the summer is going to be upon you, you just need this time and you feel good about it because this is, of course, is religious as well.
And indeed, so people really, really looked forward to it. And of course, in olden days, we just, never mind children, but adults just simply didn't have the indulgences we have now or the ability to go out and buy whatever we want whenever we wanted. So it was very, very special. Clodagh, when people were looking towards Easter, they were also preparing their homes because it wasn't just about the food. It's springtime. It's time maybe to clean your house. And there was a tradition regarding the palms after Palm Sunday. Talk to us about how our homes would be looked after.
Yes, of course, you had to welcome the risen Christ to your life, to your home as well. So there's very much traditions of cleaning the house, cleaning all the ornaments in the house, painting at this time, and also preparing for the spring more generally, sowing crops. Good Friday was a good day to start sowing your potatoes if you hadn't done so on St. Patrick's Day. So all of that kind of preparation in welcoming the rest of the year as well as welcoming the risen Christ. And of course, people would have attended various services and masses at various points during the week. On Palm Sunday, they would have attended Mass and brought a piece of palm to be blessed. It wasn't often palm. It might be yew or something like that. But the items would be blessed at Mass and brought home and hung up in the house. They were seen to bring a blessing to the house or good luck to the house for the rest of the year. And they might be taken down the following year and burned and the new palm brought in. And the palm might be put in the outhouses and the sheds to bring luck to the animals as well and the economic activities of the household during the year as well.
Now, I understand that among the celebrations and the Mass on Holy Thursday, there was another tradition that went on where people would get their hair cut. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was called Clipping Thursday or Clip Thursday. And you get your hair cut, I suppose, to prepare yourself for Easter. You're nice and neat and tidy for the going to Mass or to church on the Sunday in your best clothes. So you'd have your hair cut. And there are lots of traditions around then what you do with the hair, because people were quite concerned that their hair might be lost. So you'd put your hair in your house, in nooks and crannies in your house, gaps in the wall, under the rafters or something like that. So you could preserve your hair because it was expected you would need all of your body pieces on the last day when it came to resurrection or judgment. And you'd be sent out to look for all the bits of yourself you had left behind if you hadn't them all with you. So, you had to remember all of these other things as well when you were cutting your hair.
How fascinating. How fascinating. I'm kind of glad some of those traditions aren't still with us, but I will certainly take the simnel cake and the hot crust buns and the chocolate. Kelly, finish with you then. What is your favourite Easter tradition?
Ooh. It has to be the Easter egg hunt. I love it. And who gets the most of that? Who gets the most eggs? And then you can be magnanimous and share them afterwards. And you feel like you've done a bit of work. You've earned it. And I love enjoying it then.
All right. Okay. Well, listen, you go and enjoy that. And to both of you, Kelly Fitzgerald, Professor of Folklore in UCD, and Clodagh Tait from Mary Immaculate College in Limerick, thank you both for joining me on The Home Show, and have a wonderful chocolate and tradition-filled Easter Sunday. Now, we are in the full swing of Easter. We had lots before the break about traditions and old-fashioned foods and where all that came from. But we are bringing ourselves right up to date with tomorrow's Easter Sunday meal, because I am joined by Niamh Marr, Commercial Creative Director at thejournal.ie. Niamh, you, once again, have been shopping.
I have.
We can't stop you.
I know. It's actually very good for me, though. But this is lastminute.com shopping,
yeah,
which I'm very good at, because if you haven't decorated for Easter Sunday, which is tomorrow, then congratulations, you are a normal human being like myself.
It has come up very quickly this year though,
hasn't
it? It's
come up very quickly, and to be honest with you, there's so many different things throughout the year. Easter decorating, it tends to be the thing that just falls by the wayside for me and for a lot of people, I think, because life is busy. And look, there are things that you can do if you haven't decorated on the cheap. cheap, like me. So I did go shopping, but very much for last minute decor ideas. If you've got people coming over, but even if you don't have people coming over and you just want to make a teeny bit of an effort, but also not make any effort at all. That's what I'm in the mood
that's
for
today. That's why we love you. That's why we have you
here. And it's Saturday morning, so let's all just chill out a little bit and go easy on ourselves.
Okay. Now, of course, we can go greenery and early flowers and kind of palm leaves and all that kind of stuff. So we can decorate the table quite easily, can we?
We absolutely can. So the first thing that I think is a very easy thing to do is basically an Easter tree. So this is if you already have... So don't panic. It's very easy. If you already have a tree or a faux tree or some pieces of twigs, even run out to the garden, get yourself some twigs if you want to make a centerpiece. And this is how to quickly make an Easter tree display. So basically, if you want to and you get in there early, like now in the next hour or so, you can still get next day delivery on Amazon. They have 10 wooden eggs for €11. And basically they come and you can keep them wooden if you want, very pared back, neutral. Or you can, if you want to this afternoon, give them a little paint, wrap them up in ribbon. But basically you just hang them off whatever you see hanging and you instantly have an Easter tree. So you can make this a display in the middle of the tree, or the tree, do you hear me? In the middle of the table if you want. Or you can hang them off any faux foliage that you already have around the house. And then it's instantly an Easter decor.
That's a fun thing for the kids to do maybe this afternoon, isn't it?
Really fun for the kids.
Finger paint the spots on them or, you know, draw little bunnies or whatever.
Exactly. Next day delivery so they can arrive by tomorrow if you want to. If all else fails, hard boiled eggs. It's all about eggs at Easter, of course. So you can hard boil some eggs and you can wrap them up with ribbon that you probably already have lying around and you can hang them off foliage or twigs or trees or a plant.
Perfect.
Or anything. Really.
Perfect. And then tomorrow you can take off all the shell and make your sandwiches out of it.
Exactly.
There's me, my practical head on me there. Fantastic. Okay. Now the table itself then.
Yep.
So we're into pastels. Is it too early?
It's never too early. I love springtime. So Easter is definitely the gateway drug for me when it comes to pastels and enjoying spring. So there's a few different ways that you can decorate your table, you know, without a huge amount of effort. Bunny fold napkins. So this how-to is inspired by Martha Stewart. So you can find the how-to of how you can fold your napkins like bunny ears over on www.marthastewart.com. But also, I was going to explain how to fold them into an Easter bunny ear, and I thought that's actually the radio equivalent of watching paint dry. So I thought for your listeners and for yourself, Sinead, I'm going to spare you.
Well, certainly if I was the pupil, I think it would all come to nothing.
It'll sound more complicated, but it's actually very easy. The one thing I will say is that if you have linen napkins, you know, you want a little bit of an oomph about them so that they hold up the bunny ears. But there are dozens of how-tos on YouTube of how to turn your napkins into little bunny ears, which just instantly elevate the decor of an Easter table. Now, if you want to take it one step further and you want to get out to the art and hobby shop today at some point and you want to decorate your chairs with bunny tails, this is a really fun one. So this is perfect for a post-Easter egg hunt. It will impress littles and large guests alike and it's incredibly easy. All you need is some thick ribbon and white pom-poms. Supersize the pom-poms. If possible, you can pick them up in any art and hobby shop for less than €2. And then you just kind of wrap the big ribbon around the chairs, a la a 2000s wedding, if you will. And then you stick the pom-pom on the back of the ribbon and voila, every single person sitting at your dinner table is a bunny. So cute, so easy, and people will be agog. They'll be like, oh my God, the effort you went to. Didn't go to any effort at all. Just stuck a pom-pom on the back of the chair. Perfect.
This is the content we are here for today. That is fantastic. Actually, that just sounds gorgeous.
It's lovely. And it
sounds
lovely.
So cute.
And all the kids will love it. But also, you know, the grown-ups will appreciate it as well. So it's a nice little touch.
I suppose if you can't get out and you can't do any of that, you can do little mini tails with maybe cotton wool buds stuck together or something like that and
Absolutely.
Stick it on a piece of ribbon.
Stick them onto your husband. Stick them anywhere you want. Put bunny tails on everything in sight for Easter. It's the weekend to do it.
Why not? Now, when we think about the colour scheme, we're obviously thinking about pastels. But what other kind of ways can we use colour and pattern?
Absolutely. Well, look, if you've got some time, I think tablecloths are a really easy way to elevate and to instantly kind of celebrate Easter time. It's the only time that you can probably get away with this particular tablecloth, but next day delivery. So if you want to order this now, you'll get it for tomorrow and it will be lovely. It's a Daisy Bee tablecloth. So it's all about colour for Easter, of course. And this is a beautiful shade of yellow. It's got daisies on it. It's got bees on it. So your guests are going to be swatting the tablecloth, thinking that it's real, but it's not real and it's glorious. They come in a good size range as well, from €36 to €42. And it's lovely and it's right in the mood of Easter holidays. So it really will bring the outside in if, you know, the weather is not going to play ball for tomorrow, which, let's be honest, it probably
isn't. It may not. But we hope we'll get rid of it now, the bad weather for this year, and we'll be into a glorious summer. Isn't that what you're suggesting?
This is exactly it. There's also other tablecloths on next. Go gingham as well. Gingham, which you can use then throughout the entire there. It's a little bit less, you know, there's no actual live animals on it, but gingham is so beautiful and very reminiscent of beautiful Easter bunny weekends. So,
and the thing with all these colours and types of tablecloths and all of that is that will translate very easily to our outdoor eating area over the next few months.
Exactly. These next tablecloths in particular, they're really good value at around €39. They're 100% cotton as well, machine washable, so they're very easy to use, and you can utilise them outside as well as inside. And that's what Easter is about, I feel like. It's like the welcoming in of spring. So bring the outside in and then it's the start of the summer, hopefully.
Fantastic. And don't forget to serve your little Easter eggs in your Easter egg cups. My kids used to love that at breakfast time because it was so indulgent and very bold.
Absolutely. This is it. It's a time to be indulgent, isn't it? We all deserve it.
We certainly do. All right. Niamh Marr, thank you so much for joining us with that. Of course, you can find out more about Niamh and her ideas. Always very creative.
Absolutely. On Instagram, Niamh_Marr. I will be decorating today as well with all my own last minute ideas. So you'll see them on my Instagram there.
Fantastic. All right. Well, look, let us know what your own Easter decorations are. No pressure now. No pressure. But there's some really, really simple things that you could do. Whip up in the next couple of hours this afternoon. And it has the added benefit maybe of keeping the kids busy for a while. That is all we have time for on this Easter weekend. I wish everybody listening a wonderful Easter break, and of course we have a bank holiday as well, which is always a good addendum to any special occasion. That is all we have time for. If you'd like to get involved in the show or suggest guests or topics for us, we'd love to hear from you. You can contact me over on Instagram at SineadRyan100, which lots of you do. Or you can, of course, email us at the show, thehomeshow@newstalk.com, and we will pick that up during the week. And don't forget to check out the podcast. So if there's any items you missed, from Hugh Wallace at the top of the show to our history items, or you'd like to listen back to Niamh and all of her tips and hints there. Well, of course, our pod is up on newstalk.com or on the Newstalk app, which is powered by Go Loud. My thanks to producer Aidan McKelvey this week. Stephen McLoone was on sound, and Anton Savage is up next. We'll be back next Saturday at 8 a.m. and we look forward to your company.
The Home Show with Sinead Ryan. Saturday morning at 8 on Newstalk.